Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today is Election Day in San Francisco and many states across the country, so don't forget to vote, and we will discuss results on Friday's show. Today, we are continuing our coverage on the California fires by talking about how people in the most vulnerable communities and small businesses are coping. Every time California has a devastating fire, we hear and read about stark inequalities. Those with means can leave the area, stay in a hotel, and then rebuild. Or in the case of power outages, they can purchase generators or solar batteries. But those who are low income have very few choices. They can stay with friends or relatives if they have room. In the case of the Kincade Fire, people were sleeping in their cars in big box parking lots or anywhere that felt safe. The LA Times reported that most people living in Lake County, which is 3 hours north of San Francisco, live paycheck to paycheck, and buying even extra blankets and losing a week's worth of food causes many to struggle to pay rent. Last week, we learned that immigrants were being taken to Sonoma County vineyards to pick grapes with no masks as the fires burned nearby. According to Data USA, an estimated 38,000 undocumented immigrants live in Sonoma County, and undocumented families cannot receive federal assistance even after something as devastating as a wildfire. And then there are small businesses. Small business owners are coming to terms with several days of lost revenue because of the power outages. In fact, we heard from one small business owner last week who said he lost $40,000 in revenue, and the trickle-down effect is huge. And this is not just a California problem, of course. This is a nationwide problem. When disasters strike, the most vulnerable are hit the hardest. So how are these populations coping, and what changes need to happen to address these issues? Joining us now is Mallory Mensch, a business reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. Mallory was in Sonoma County talking to families and business owners about these issues. Hi, Mallory. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Now that the fires are mostly contained, thanks to first responders who've done an amazing job, people are heading back to their properties to see how their homes are doing. And small business owners are, you know, trying to get back on their feet after losing a lot of money from lost revenue. You were reporting in Novato, speaking with small business owners. What really stands out for you? What did they tell you?
Well, I was speaking with one in particular who actually was able to get generators through some friends. They weren't able to find any because they were flying off the shelves. There was such a high demand. And they said they were lucky to still be able to stay open, but they were actually one of the only businesses on a main street in Novato that was able to stay open. I spoke with the business owner right when the power was shut off the Saturday before last. And they were keeping things open with generators, keeping the kitchen running, the fridge running. They also had strung up lights from her wedding a couple years ago in the main dining room so people could still see. And she really expressed that they were incredibly lucky. You know, not only would it have been a huge loss for them to close, especially on a Saturday night when they had some large parties and had a birthday party booked for about 30 people, that would have been a lot of loss of revenue for them. But she also said, you know, for the people that she employs, I think it was about 24 people, they would have lost wages. And I think that really drove home the point that the people who are worst affected and hardest hit in this are those who, like you said, are living paycheck to paycheck, who don't have the means to run out and buy the backup batteries that they might need, who perhaps have a very limited income for budgeted for groceries every month or every week. And if everything in their fridge spoils, it's difficult to try and get that back. So, fortunately, she was able to keep going. I spoke with some other business owners in the East Bay who said that they were going to lose thousands of dollars, like you mentioned, and workers would be out of work during that time.
What's so unique about this fire this time around is that such a huge number of people lost power from, you know, Santa Rosa to the East Bay all the way up to Mill Valley. I was driving through Marin, I think it was two Sundays ago, and it was like a ghost town, and it was the middle of the day. The major grocery stores mm-hmm. there were shut down. All the small businesses were shut down. So this really affected a lot of people this time around. And the trickle-down effect is huge because it affects vendors, and then, as you said, it also affects employees.
That's exactly right. It was strange to be in some of, I was also in Novato, I think, on Monday of that week, and it was dead. There was no one there. I passed by one person who asked me if there was Wi-Fi. It was the only person that I saw on the street because I was using my computer to work. But it really did make some of these places, especially the business areas, really grind to a halt. And that means that it's then also difficult, not only for those who are running the businesses, but for residents who need to get things. So we saw that everything was running out. Like I mentioned, generators, ice was a common thing that restaurants and grocery stores were running out of, batteries as well, just the basic things that people need. And that's assuming, of course, that you can afford to make those expenses. Gas was also something that ran out, which was of concern for people, especially if they might need to leave at sudden notice.
And Mallory, the other thing that's really striking is PG&E says these outages are going to happen for the next 10 years, which is very hard to wrap your head around, especially after this last set of outages. So until citizens and government officials and PG&E officials decide what's next for that utility company, we might see outages, say, in the next 6 months. Have you been able to talk to state officials about how they plan to deal with this?
So I haven't personally spoken with any state officials, but
or
I
even local.
Been in touch, yes, exactly, with many county and local officials. Many said this was an incredibly high cost for them as well. So San Jose's mayor in particular has been very outspoken about it. He estimates that the first power outage, which lasted just a day or two, cost the city $500,000. He's now pushing for to create a separate utility or to have PG&E become customer-owned or publicly owned. Others have been pushing for compensation. I know that the governor has also pushed that PG&E should give compensation to some to every individual or every resident and business affected. PG&E has initially said that they would not be doing this, you know, that there people could submit claims if they wanted to. But I believe it's something that they might be considering. But in the meantime, you know, until some policies or the structure of the utility changes, like you said, we do anticipate that we will be dealing with this. So then that turns to local officials, to municipal governments, to nonprofits, which are trying to scramble to know how to deal with this. So during the power outages, we saw community centers were set up as pseudo emergency centers where people could just simply go and charge their devices or receive assistance if they needed to. So a lot of this burden is falling back on the local governments who are trying to understand how to deal with this and trying to serve their residents in the meantime.
And then sticking with wages for a few more minutes, the LA Times had an incredible piece about people living up in Lake County, which is 3 hours north of San Francisco. And a large population there live paycheck to paycheck. And so buying extra blankets is even difficult, especially when you lose a week's worth of food. And the timing was really bad because people had to pay their rent just a couple of days ago.
That's exactly right. And some of my colleagues did a similar investigation, and they'd actually focus on Lake County as well. You know, they looked at the numbers of households that are receiving food assistance and are also in the publicly funded health insurance program, Medi-Cal, and they found that that was thousands, actually hundreds of thousands of people were on Medi-Cal in these heavily impacted areas. So in Lake County in particular, you know, they did issue a local emergency proclamation saying that people here are dealing with this overwhelming hardship. You know, for some people that was, you know, trying to understand and figure out how they were going to keep their medical devices running. You know, that was a big concern if people depend on medical devices that need electricity. They either had to find a backup battery or some other way to deal with that. I met a woman, not in Lake County, but in Marin County in San Rafael, who lives in a temporary shelter that's run by a nonprofit. And she uses a nebulizer, a breathing device, because she has asthma and some other breathing conditions. And she's fortunate enough to be in this temporary shelter where she receives assistance and will hopefully move on to more permanent housing. But the director of that shelter was very concerned about her, obviously, and so invested in an extra backup battery for her, but that's not something that that woman could have afforded on her own. And that's the case for many people, especially in more rural, isolated communities like in Lake County.
Right. That's a huge issue. People with health issues, people with disabilities, babies, and then the elderly. I mean, there are so many populations that are in need of devices, for example, that plug in and really in need of warmth.
Exactly.
So what about this issue? Because, for example, again, you spoke to this woman at in a temporary housing shelter in San Rafael. How was the shelter coping?
Yeah, so the shelter, they emphasized that they are prepared for any disaster, and they really were. The director said, we are ready to, it's a shelter in a, on the upper level, about 13 people live there. She said most of them have some medical condition or some disability that needs extra attention. And on the lower level is a free dining room, so anyone can come in and get breakfast and lunch and take away dinner for the evening as well. She said, we are prepared to continue serving hundreds of people for 2 weeks. So I guess if the outage went longer than 2 weeks, they would hit some trouble. But they did not have a generator or any backup power, but they had non-perishable items, food that they could still hand out to people, and they were still able to keep things running. And the director of the shelter, I checked in with her a few days after the outage started, when power was beginning to be restored. She said they saw a 50% increase in the people who came in simply for a meal. People she said she never seen before. She mentioned a lot of elderly people in the neighborhood who were just looking for a meal and were, you know, wouldn't necessarily come in usually, but because they didn't have power at home and maybe didn't have those extra resources, they needed to come in there. So she was really prepared for anything, and they were prepared to still help people, but she said, you know, these are the people who don't have the extra resources, who are hit hardest in this. And she mentioned for the homeless as well, that they also serve, you know, every day is an emergency. So this is something that is affecting those who are living on the streets, who don't have enough food, or also are affected by the air quality during fires like this.
Wow, this woman who runs the shelter sounds amazing. I mean, that's the other thing that it was incredible to read about all of the people who came forward to help. Right after people started going home, I saw in Santa Rosa that a number of community organizations reached out to grocery stores and anyone who would donate food so people can restock their refrigerators. So, I mean, the community just really came together to make sure that, you know, people had what they needed.
And I think it's those small acts of kindness as well from strangers that I think it did bring out the best in some people. I met a woman who had evacuated from the Kincaid fire from her home in Santa Rosa. This was last Monday. And she was staying with a friend in Rohnert Park. It's a little bit south of Santa Rosa. But she was at Walmart with her five kids getting some things that she needs. Actually, her two-year-old son has a congenital heart defect. So she needed to go back to her house to get the oxygen tanks. She had been hand-feeding him through a tube because he usually has a device that runs on electricity. And they went into Walmart. They stocked up on everything they need to take back to their friend's house. And while they were there, they stopped at McDonald's. And she told me that the woman behind her in line, a stranger, she doesn't know who she is, she just offered to pay for their lunch for her and her five kids, which she said was not necessarily a small cost. So that was something that really struck her, that she wanted to point out that you know, people in the area were compassionate, that they were trying to help out other people who were in more difficult situations than them.
Wow. And so many stories like that. That is Mallory Mensch, a business reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. She has been in Sonoma County talking to families and business owners about all of these issues. How are people coping? And there's so many unanswered questions here. If this is going to continue happening, especially with the power outages, how are government officials going to respond to this, especially for the most vulnerable communities and for small businesses that are struggling to stay open? What are your thoughts on this? If you were affected, we'd love to hear from you. And what sort of changes do you want to see? Because this is just not sustainable. It's great that people are coming forward and there's great community out there, but how do you sustain this? 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Now I would like to welcome James Elliott to the show. James is professor and chair of sociology at Rice University. According to a study he conducted with University of Pittsburgh assistant professor Junina Howell, as local hazard damages increase, so does wealth inequality, especially along lines of race, education, and home ownership. Jim is a proud UCSC BA in sociology class of 89. Hi, Jim. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Rose. You're welcome.
Well, you heard part of our conversation with Mallory. She did some great reporting in Sonoma County where so many people were evacuated or lost their power. And, you know, you've done a lot of studies on this. It really does hit the vulnerable the most. And Jim, I just wonder, you know, PG&E has said, expect these kinds of outages for the next 10 years. And, you know, we're waiting to hear from government officials about how they're going to deal with this.
That's right. You know, aside from the fires, California does have that unique problem with PG&E. Then you get to the larger issues where, you know, the wildfires there are doing their damage, you know, both short and long term. But you've got tornadoes in other places in the country, flooding, hurricanes, sea level rise. So, you know, if you look across the country, this is not just a Northern California problem or a wildfire problem. This really is an American problem. And I think the points that Mallory made are really important to actually get out there and document what people are doing, individuals are doing for one another. And within sociology, there's research on this that sometimes talks about that early phase of disasters, such as the one, the fires that are going on there now, in terms of what you might call a therapeutic community. People rise to the challenge and help one another. And then as time goes forward, the recovery efforts take longer and longer, and that therapeutic community is hard to sustain, as you pointed out. And so then the question is, what do we need to do as a society and through policy and different efforts to, you know, make that longer-term recovery actually something that heals and builds a more sustainable and less vulnerable, you know, future and doesn't contribute to the inequalities that we see in our research and we think, you know, begins to stretch the social fabric in ways that when it happens next time, things are even going to be harder to repair and harder to sort of address because you have these inequalities actually widening.
Right. Mallory, to that point, were you able to talk to anyone who is still trying to recover from last year's fire?
I spoke with people definitely who knew those who had lost everything. You know, they said, this isn't the first time that we've been doing this. I actually spoke with a family who had evacuated from their home in Sebastopol, and they were staying in the parking lot of a Kohl's in Roner Park, I believe it was, or Petaluma. And they had said that their one of their fathers had actually lost a home in the fire 2 years ago and had decided to leave the area. He actually moved to Oregon, and he wasn't the only person I spoke with. Some people who said, you know, I'm considering moving or I might move in the future because this is too stressful to deal with, or I'm still exactly recovering from what happened last year or the year before.
Jim, when you look at what happened with people who lost their homes last time around, those who owned their own homes and had insurance, a lot of people rebuilt. According to NBC News, 26 insurance companies agreed to voluntarily extend the living benefits for survivors of those 2017 fires who are still rebuilding their homes. Nationwide was not one of them. You know, there's a lot of questions about insurance and how they deal with this. But this also, there's stark inequalities here between people who own their homes and have insurance and people who don't own their homes, or people who do own their homes and don't have insurance.
And that's right. And that's sort of the bigger concern, right? Because what we're looking at is a situation where many of the recovery policies, whether they be actual policies through private insurance companies or their policies that are in that quasi-market. So, for instance, here in Houston, we've had 3 500-year floods in the last 5 years, and the flood insurance is there, but it's for property owners, and it's subsidized by taxpayers. And then you have the federal government with their other programs. And part of the challenge I think we face is that so much of our recovery effort, once we get past the immediate temporary needs phase and we go into long-term recovery, is definitely geared towards restoring property. This means that, for instance, if you have more property, which is basically a form of wealth, the more you can expect to sort of get returned. This does not discount the trauma that people go through, and it doesn't mean that everybody's well insured, but those people who can afford insurance actually get a bit of a bump in a public subsidy, because most of the insurance, what it's doing is socializing risk, right? It's sending out the cost of that across a wider span of people, whether it's through taxes or insurance premiums, and then funneling, you know, money disproportionately back to the people who have more property insured. And so that begins to set up something where you talked about the repetitive impacts. If this keeps going on year after year, it can really begin to mount up and create these wealth inequalities. And on that point, in our research where we looked at these things over about a 15-year span and what happens when people sort of suffer these things over time where they live, we also found not just the wealth inequalities, but also what we call housing insecurity. You know, people who are renters, as you might expect, and we began to see, or people of color, or people with lower incomes or educations, are basically moving more because of this. And then as a result of that, oftentimes they're disrupted from their local communities or their social ties, which are helpful in their long-term recovery. So if you're moving around sort of not by choice, but sort of solve these ongoing recurrent problems, and the aid is coming initially but then begins to peel off to people who have property, that's not a long-term solution for sustainable communities.
And in a state like California, where housing prices are already so high, it's incredibly difficult to find housing after you lose a home. I mean, I grew up in Petaluma, which is about 45 minutes, an hour north of San Francisco, and I cannot believe how high the rents are in Petaluma. I never thought I would see these high rents. So what about that, Jim? I mean, it just, the problem is exacerbated in a place like California.
It is, and I have good friends who live in the Santa Rosa area and whose mother actually lost her home in the fires a couple of years ago, so I know how that plays out. They're in a fortunate position. They've been able to absorb that, but one of the things that happens is you're absolutely right to make the connection, not just to property, but to housing, which is this question of, do people have a right to housing? And so this begins to open up disaster recovery to those types of larger questions. But we know in the short term, if you have large-scale floods or fires or other impacts from natural hazards, oftentimes the housing stock is diminished. So the short-term response is that oftentimes if you have diminished supply and oftentimes increased demand, then the rents are going to go up. So in California, it's already too high in many respects, right? And now you're going to add more to that lack of affordability. And the question is, how do we solve that? How do we begin to develop policies that actually begin to merge and connect affordable housing with long-term recovery in a way that's sustainable for all members and sort of parts of the community?
Mallory, before we let you go, you previously covered immigration, and I wonder, do you have any updates on how the immigrant community is doing? Because we learned that as the fires were raging, immigrants were being taken from the shelters to pick grapes in the Sonoma County vineyards, in many cases without masks.
Yes, and one of my colleagues actually reported on that issue and reported on the uncertainty, especially for the migrant workers who depend on these vineyards, their workplaces, for housing as well. And in some cases, that wasn't even there anymore. They didn't have a place to live. So I think there are a lot of organizations that are concerned about this. There were many that my colleague Megan Cassidy spoke to who say that they've been fielding a lot of calls from vineyard owners who do want to, you know, take care of their workers, find alternative housing. For some of these workers, they're on a temporary visa that's seasonal, so they said, well, I might go back home to my home country, for most of them, maybe Mexico or some other Central American countries, before their time is up, which means that they're losing those wages and the reason that they came here. So even if they still have a home to go back to, they might not get the benefits, which are the reason for which they came, which is to support their families.
Well, Mallory, thank you so much for your great reporting. We'd love to have you back, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Mallory Mensch is a business reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. She has been in Sonoma County talking to families and businesses about how they are coping, and you can find her stories at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we'll continue speaking with Jim Elliott, professor and chair of sociology at Rice University. He conducted a study that looked at what happens when these kinds of disasters increase. We also see an increase in wealth inequality, especially along lines of race, education, and home ownership. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion, or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will be talking about the teacher strikes sweeping the country with public education advocate Diane Ravitch. The most recent strike in Chicago was that city's longest teacher strike in more than three decades. We will find out what is in their contract and, more broadly, what teachers have won and what it'll take to fully fund public education. Friday, we will be talking about election results. Today is election day in San Francisco and many states across the country. There are a lot of important races out there, so please vote. Encourage friends and family to vote. You know that on off election years, voter turnout is pretty low, so if you can spread the word, that would be great. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are continuing our coverage on the fires by talking about how vulnerable communities and small businesses are coping. And if you have a personal story to share or you'd like to talk about how government officials should start to deal with this, we'd love to hear from you, especially as PG&E says these outages are going to happen on a regular basis for the next 10 years. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Jim Elliott is professor and chair of sociology at Rice University, and he studies these issues. He also found that at any given level of local damage, the more aid an area receives from FEMA, the more this inequality grows. And we'll talk about that with Jim in just a couple of minutes. Joining us now is Beatrice Camacho, a housing organizer for North Bay Organizing Project. It's a grassroots, multiracial, and multi-issue organization comprised of environmental, labor, student, and community organizations in Sonoma County. Hi, Beatrice. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having me again.
Well, I thank you so much. I know that you're taking time out of your day to talk to us, even though you're still working really hard to help people who were affected by or displaced by the Kincaid fire. So what really stands out for you at this time? What are the immediate and long-term needs right now?
The immediate needs we're seeing right now is just the immediate need for aid, for folks to be able to replenish the refrigerators, for folks to be able to make ends meet and pay their rent. We are seeing a lot of, you know, services, people, individuals, organizations coming and supporting, but we are seeing that a big impact that we're able to make is through immediate and relief aid, through cash aid that we've been doing in partnership with Corazon Hillsburg, something that Community Action Partnership here in Sonoma County is doing as well. We're seeing families that are just, they're needing support. A local assistance center has opened up at the Hillsburg Community Center. They were scheduled to be there yesterday through tomorrow, but I'm hearing that it's probably going to extend a few more days. I had one of my colleagues that went out there yesterday and she was doing an intake with the family at 6:30 in the evening, and the family had been there since about 10 a.m. There were a lot of families that are coming out that are needing support, folks that have not been able to work, so they're not able to bring in, you know, a salary. They're not able to pay their rent. I keep highlighting rent. That's the work that I'm doing, and that's oftentimes the stories that I'm hearing. Sometimes individuals that, you know, I've been interacting with throughout these this last week, 2 weeks, they think about the immediate need about, you know, they need gas to get to one place right now. They need food right now. And then we start getting into more conversation about, well, what about when you go back, you know, to your communities? Do you have a home to go back to? When you go back to that home, you know, what are the resources and what is it that you need? And oftentimes that's what comes up for them. And so we're trying to figure out how we're able to support and how we're able to get on top of that. We've also, as I shared when I was on with you all last week, as the Kincaid fire was starting, we had our organizations that were starting up on DocuFund to support our undocumented communities. You know, just as you shared, there's there are federal organizations, there's FEMA, but our undocumented community doesn't qualify for that. So we started that up as the fire was happening because we knew that there was going to be a dire need for our undocumented communities. And right now we have about 700 applications that we are starting with, and this Saturday we're going to start to distribute some of those funds, and we're continuing with raising money for that because we know that's going to be a long-term need.
Wow, 700 applications. Can you elaborate on this a bit, Beatrice? Undocumented workers cannot receive statewide unemployment insurance benefits. I mean, what other benefits? Is there any sort of assistance? I guess that's the question. Any assistance they can receive from the government?
Honestly, that I know of, there isn't, which is why it's so important that we have these local nonprofit organizations like Corazon Healdsburg that are able to provide immediate assistance and relief to these families. No questions asked, you know. So when we have been doing intakes through Corazon Healdsburg, we don't ask about immigration status. It's just what is the need that you have right now, where all of these, you know, federal assistance organizations, that is a question that is asked.
Jim, what about this? There are 38,500 undocumented immigrants just in Sonoma County alone, and a lot of immigrants are struggling to begin with. And when the fires or disasters happen, it just makes it incredibly difficult to make ends meet. Have you looked at the immigrant community and how they're affected in your studies?
Not directly, but first, before I respond more broadly, I want to thank Beatrice for all the work she and her group are doing. That's really important. And one of the, I don't know if it's an irony, but one of the big picture items that seems to be emerging when I talk to colleagues who study the immigrant and sometimes the undocumented community is the question of the longer-term recovery. Who's actually doing the dangerous recovery work of rebuilding and doing the stuff? And if you look at this, a large proportion of the construction industry, particularly roofers who are doing dangerous work, it's, I think, the most dangerous or second most dangerous occupation in terms of injuries in the U.S., a huge proportion of that workforce is, you know, foreign-born, largely Mexican and Central American laborers, and they get very few protections. They're subcontracted out a lot of different ways, and so you have that community sort of coming in and sometimes inadvertently competing for housing or trying to find places to live and shelter while they're participating in the work of the recovery. And we see this particularly along the Gulf and in Texas, but throughout the U.S. In studies I've heard. And so you have the renter issues there. And my understanding of FEMA is that, you know, it's not just the local laws, as Beatrice pointed out, but also FEMA aid, temporary assistance, is not allowed to be given, as far as I understand, to undocumented workers. So you have that. Then you have the usual issues of evictions and rentals, right? So evictions don't stop. We don't have a policy that says, okay, this is a time of emergency, you shouldn't kick people out of housing. We allow that to go on. So, for instance, when Hurricane Hurricane Harvey hit here and became the second most costly natural disaster in U.S. history, the central county of Harris County of the Houston metro area evicted 4,500 people, took the opportunity to basically kick them out because they couldn't get their rent in that day. They had just 2 days to get it done during the storm. So the landlords, if they chose, could do that and then begin to rent out at a higher cost. So then the dominoes of the sort of shrinking housing stock begin to push forward and displacing those who have the least sort of claim on property. And that's oftentimes not just people of color, but of course people who are also marginalized by a lack of citizenship or appropriate documents.
Right. And Beatrice, Mallory Mensch from the San Francisco Chronicle said that some of the worker housing for immigrants who worked at the wineries and the vineyards was lost. Do you have any updates on that?
Right. I don't have updates. I know that there are some that were lost, and I know that wineries are trying to work together. But just, you know, to speak to the work that our undocumented or immigrant communities are doing, you know, I know that when the Kincade Fire hit, there was still about like 8 to 10% of the season's grapes that were left to pick. And we heard the slogan, safety first, then economy, yet we were seeing so many vineyard workers that were being picked up and taken to pick the remainder of the grapes in the mandatory evacuation areas. And even if they were wearing masks, to me, hearing that sounds like it's economy first and safety second. So just seeing that and seeing this like labor extraction that's happening, and especially happening during these times of crisis, it's just, it's hard to see and it's hard to hear, and it's something that is significantly impacting our undocumented community, our immigrant community. And then also just to speak a little bit to the fact that evictions don't stop when we have, you know, natural disasters. We do have a state of emergency that we've had here in Sonoma County since 2017, when we had the Tubbs fire, where rents can't be increased more than 10%. And Governor Newsom has extended that for the entire state, yet that doesn't apply to evictions. And we also know that here in the state of California, come January, we have a new piece of legislation that's going to go into effect, AB 1482, which is there's a 5% plus CPI rent cap and just cause eviction attached to that. And in expecting that to go into effect in January, we were anticipating evictions happening at the end of this year already before the fire happening. And we are still hearing of that happening. So there's so many things that our renters, our tenant population is being hit with right now in addition to this catastrophic fire.
That is Beatrice Camacho. She is housing organizer for North Bay Organizing Project. It's a grassroots, multiracial and multi-issue organization working in Sonoma County. They are currently providing relief to wildfire victims across Sonoma County, especially for the Spanish-speaking immigrant and undocumented populations there. And when we say wildfire victims, we're talking about, you know, people who've lost their jobs, people who couldn't work, people who lost their power. This time around, there's a lot of people who were affected. And so we will put links up to the organizations that Beatrice is working with if you would like to help. As she said, they just received 700 applications. And at this time, cash is most effective so people can replenish their refrigerators and pay their rent. We're also joined by Jim Elliott, professor and chair of sociology at Rice University. Jim studies these issues. He looked at a number of communities over a 15-year span to find out how they were dealing with disasters. And if you have any questions or comments or a personal story, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Beatrice, given that PG&E says we're going to lose power in the near future, what are you hearing from local officials about how they're going to deal with this? I mean, there are so many layers, from immigrants to the elderly to people with disabilities to babies. I mean, there's just so many layers here.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't have an answer for that because I've been so on the ground that I haven't moved my way up to the local government level. But, yeah, it is something that's impacting all of us. I'm in an area that's been impacted every single time, like, you know, each time that they've done the power shut off this year. And it just, it shifts your days, it shifts your life, what you're doing. And I'm fortunate enough to be able-bodied and to have, you know, resources to get myself to where I need to be if I do need power. But I think that those are big conversations that are needing to happen with our local government, our county government, because if this is the new norm, then we need some systems in place to be able to live and to work through these conditions.
Jim, how are local governments or state governments dealing with these kinds of disasters in other parts of the country? Does anything stand out for you?
Yeah, and this gets to the broader point. You asked about FEMA and what can be done, and I think it's going to be on the ground in those local efforts, but then it's going to be a slower, longer, I think, struggle to sort of bring this issue into the courts through different lawsuits and into the legislature and talking about, you know, expanding FEMA's responsibilities to actually attend and monitor what happens after they get involved. But in that process alone, if you just look at the federal level and the response there before you get to the state and the local, there are a couple of things that stand out. One is that there are literally dozens of different organizations and agencies that operate with FEMA during these longer term recoveries. So you have, for instance, the Housing and Urban Development Agency, or you have the Small Business Administration, the Army Corps of Engineers working on infrastructure, et cetera. And to be honest, one of the things that we don't know is what's all happening through those different agencies. So the FEMA report or strategic plan that was released last year, sort of a five-year visioning statement, included in that a need to get more transparency on what's happening at the federal level and actually improve data analytics so we can get a better answer to the question you're asking. And then that needs to then trickle down to the state and local level. And my suspicion is, or expectation is, that different states are doing different things, some better than others. For instance, here in Texas, one of the things that happens with the floods that have happened the last 3 years is that the Department of Environmental Quality will basically suspend pollution regulations, and so companies can basically dump and release things into the environment without any penalty because it's considered a weird weather event and they can't possibly control their output. And so now we're having legal issues about what that does to communities long term. And so we need to focus not just on the federal dimensions of this stuff, but then how it plays out, as you mentioned, through different states and local agencies. And this is all complicated by the fact that when a federal declaration of disaster is declared, that releases money from the federal government, but that money then goes to the state, and the state legislature makes decisions about where it's going to go, and then it goes down to the local level, and then those people are making decisions. So the money doesn't go straight to the local level, and so you can imagine that that begins to complicate things.
Wow. Well, right. And what other changes or differences do you see between like a very wealthy state like California? What's so sad, but I think really important about these events, is it really shows people just how much inequality is in a state like California, where we often hear about big tech, about billionaires, about the fact that we're the fifth largest economy in the world. But when you go deeper, you learn that there's so much inequality and a lot of people struggling to make ends meet.
And that's right. And, you know, one can debate whether it's FEMA's job to fix that inequality, but I think it's an easier call to say it shouldn't make it worse. Mm-hmm. And so our research shows that to the extent that we can get data, as imperfect as it is, but this is the data that's made available on long-term public rebuilding, we find a number of things. And all of those things begin to point to the fact that it's not just the fires or the floods that are creating this increasing wealth inequality over time as vulnerabilities cascade through less privileged communities and opportunities open up to more privileged communities. But it's also the fact that we see as money comes in from FEMA, it actually makes that situation worse. And we're not really sure why. It just seems that when the money comes in, people are just differently positioned to be able to take advantage of it. So another finding that we had just quickly is that we find that when FEMA money comes in, it also shifts how recovery works with respect to self-employment. So you can think of self-employment rates as sort of a measure of local resilience, the extent to which people can, you know, work for themselves and do this. And what we find is that the more FEMA money comes in, you know, over a long period of time, the more self-employment in a local area actually increases. But that's only for whites. They're the ones who are able to actually benefit from that. We're not sure entirely why, but if you look at self-employment rates for African Americans and Latinx populations, there is no positive effect. So we need to think about how to do better in acknowledging that and then coming back and addressing it in more deliberate ways.
Jim, the data that you're putting out is so incredibly important. Have you been in touch with many policymakers about this? Have you heard from anyone who wants to make some changes here so this doesn't happen?
Yeah, so two things. One is next week I'll actually be in Washington, D.C., making a presentation to the Government Accountability Office, so the GAO, which is the research wing of Congress. And so presenting some of this information so that they can hear firsthand. They've read some of the reports. So that's the legislative thing, and we'll keep pushing. And our hope is that we can expand the strategic plan that they put out to really focus not just on data analytics and transparency, but deliberately on how to address these inequalities and these unintended consequences that may be happening. The second big piece is I've been involved with Junia Howe, my co-author on the piece that you mentioned, in a federal lawsuit that was filed here in Texas on disproportionate FEMA aid distributed to victims of Hurricane Harvey, and trying to open up the question of what renters are able to get, since they're taxpayers paying into the FEMA pool of money. Is it fair that they're disproportionately cut out of the long-term recovery funds?
And now, Beatrice, since you have been on the ground, I mean, you have very useful information that should be shared with policymakers. I mean, I know that you haven't had time to talk with local government officials, but what would you say? I mean, what would be most effective so people are able to just have the basics when they go through these disasters?
Right. I would say to be able to have something in place, whether it's citywide or countywide, to be able to provide aid and support for our community as a whole, regardless of documentation status. Mm-hmm. Because there is that barrier, that's why we've created InDocuFund, that's why we have Corazon Hillsburg, that's why we have an organization called Movimiento Cultural de la Unión Indígena, who are providing support and interpretation in about four different indigenous languages. So individuals who don't speak Spanish, but they speak other indigenous languages and have absolutely no way of how to communicate, you know, with folks in these shelters. So we have individuals that are going and volunteering and that are able to be those translators from Triqui to Spanish to English and all of these different languages. So it's about when we're thinking about our processes for these disasters and recovery that we're taking into consideration language justice, that we're taking into consideration legal status, because we have a very broad and diverse community, and we need to make sure that when we're recovering, that everyone's recovering and not just a few.
Right. And we want to give a shout out to KBBF, multilingual radio station based in Santa Rosa. A number of outlets have been writing about this. The LA Times had an amazing story about how volunteers were working so hard to keep listeners informed about the fires in Spanish and in indigenous languages. And we're going to hopefully do a show about this station, because these people are just incredible. They provided such an amazing public service, which is what community radio stations should be doing. We have time for one caller. We have a few people who have called and said thank you for just talking about this issue, because it's so important. Before we end, let's bring in Evelyn from Berkeley, who is in a high fire zone. Hi, Evelyn. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you, and thank you for the program. What I would like to have you do is another program that might help us get legislation started, so that PG&E won't be looking only at the insurance damages. They'll be looking at the deaths to people like me who are elderly and don't have relatives who can... We didn't even know that there was going to be no electricity in our building for 3 or 4 days.
Wow.
When they turn the power off to keep from fires, that would be death for me and my pets. So I think it's an issue that I hope will get more attention.
Can I ask you, how long were you without power, Evelyn?
I have not been without power yet. PG&E decided not to turn it out in my area of Berkeley this time, but I'm looking at constant threat, and like I said, the damage, the threat, not from the fire, but from PG&E's taking protective measures against fire and insurance claims.
Mm. Well, Evelyn,
I think so. I want something that if PG&E is going to turn off my heat, my light, my ability to use oxygen, that they should take me to a hotel until they can turn the power back on.
Right. Yeah. Well, thank you for calling, Evelyn. I'm really glad your power was not turned off. And we will keep doing our best to try to get PG&E executives to join us. We did invite them last week, and they said no one was available, but we will continue to try so we can get some questions answered, because I just can't imagine that power is going to be turned off in the near term, but that's what we're hearing. So that's where we are right now. We will definitely continue following this issue. Beatrice, final thoughts. Cash at this point is the most effective way to help people?
Yes, yeah. And to be able to donate to KBBS, who you mentioned, you know, I had them playing at my home so that my mom would be able to understand what was going on too. Mm-hmm. They did an amazing job. UndocuFund, Corazon Hillsburg Unity and Community Fund, Movimiento Cultural de la Unión Indígena, North Bay Organizing Project. If folks are able to donate, you know, whether it's $5, $10, $100, whatever it can be, the support is needed, and it's going to families and community that are in need.
Well, thank you so much, Beatrice. We've got links on our website for those of you who would like to help. Thank you for your work, Beatrice. We'd love to check in with you in the coming weeks.
Thank you, Rose.
That is Beatrice Camacho, housing organizer with the North Bay Organizing Project. We've got about a minute left, Jim. What's next here? I mean, we need some changes. You know, where do you think this needs to go from here?
Well, as your caller mentioned, you've got a unique situation in California. I mean, the rest of us around the country are worried about the rising costs of these natural hazard damages. And then you throw on top of this vital utility of electricity, and it's going to be what they call a wicked problem. It's going to take a while to solve and have to be addressed on multiple fronts. And so, you know, I think that's the reality of it. I'm pleased to hear that people are taking care of each other and trying to get the language out or the word out in multiple languages. But I think, you know, the short is we've got to think about not just the disaster, but the disaster after disaster. And that's what you already are living in terms of PG&E and this sort of constant threat of not knowing if you're going to have that source. So coming to embrace that and think about the multiple ways that we can do that from the community on up, and begin, as a sociologist, I have to say, you know, realizing that these vulnerabilities that we talk about, you know, they don't just affect individuals, but the best predictor of whether or not you're suffering from an eviction or some sort of housing crisis or the energy problem that might be generated from PG&E's, you know, power outages is basically that's going to, the best predictor is someone else in your network is doing that. So it becomes this, you know, totalizing experience.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, Jim. Thank you for your work. We'd love to have you back. Jim Elliott is professor and chair of sociology at Rice University. Thank you so much. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.